Today is Tuesday, August 24th, 2021. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with James Williams. W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S is normal spelling last name, and James goes by Jim. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Jim. How are you today?
I am fine, Tom. Good morning.
Great. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do. You have my permission.
Thank you very much. Jim, what year were you born?
I was born in 1941,
and
September the 19th, 1941.
Okay, where were you born?
I was born in Wadley, W-A-D-L-E-Y, Alabama.
What were your folks doing there?
My dad was a school teacher.
Okay.
And my mom was a housewife, homemaker.
Okay. Did you have older brothers and sisters?
Oh, I did. I had one older brother and two older sisters.
Okay. What did your dad teach?
My dad was a math teacher, and he also did a little bit of coaching along the way. He coached everything from girls basketball to football.
Okay. How did your dad meet your mom?
They met in Ashland, Alabama, and they both lived in the area, and she's always tall, dark, handsome man, and that's the beginning of the story.
Okay. And what grades did your father teach?
Mostly it was junior high school, or at that time it was all high school. The grade 7 through 12.
Okay. All right. What was growing up in Alabama like? Did you grow up in Wadley then?
Oh, well, we moved from Wadley, Alabama, where I was born, to Lincoln, Alabama.
When?
Lincoln. That would have been in 1941.
Oh, the year you were born.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I only lived in Wadley. I was born there in September, and sometime later that fall, we moved to Lincoln, Alabama.
Okay.
And again, he was following teaching jobs.
Okay.
And they had an opening up there that I guess looked like it had more potential, so, and probably better pay because they were chasing money. They were so broke.
Mm.
So we moved to Lincoln, Alabama in 1941. And we lived there until 1957.
Okay.
In 1957, we moved to Brunswick, Georgia. That was my senior year in high school.
All right. Let's go back. What are some of your earliest recollections of Lincoln?
Oh, my earliest recollections of Lincoln, Alabama was basically going to the Lincoln, Alabama has a population, by the way, of 400, at the time about 400 people.
Okay.
And we would go to the store downtown. There were two stores that had canned goods and groceries and stuff, and they sold everything, one of them from tractor parts and pieces, because it's a farming community.
Okay.
To dry goods, to everything. It was Watson's General Store. And some of my early recollections are going to the General Store because there was always a chance that Mom might have a nickel and I might get a cold drink or a piece of candy out of it.
Okay.
But growing up in a small town, I had friends I grew up with, went to school with, went to church with, and so it was a very small, tight-knit community. Everybody knew everybody. Nobody locked the doors. Everybody shared everything, and it was a typical small-town Alabama.
Okay. Did you spend a lot of time out of doors?
I spent all of my time out of doors. I roamed the banks. Once I got up where I was kind of on my own and could leave the house in the summertime, and go to the swimming hole, which I did. That was one of my early recollections, actually. My sisters would take me to the creek in the summertime. And that was from our house. We walked down this old road that was formerly a road, but it had grown up in bushes and weeds and had a couple of culverts, I guess, had washed out in places. Eventually, we wound up down by Blue Eye Creek. And Blue Eye Creek had a swimming hole, which was a kind of enlarged area with a few cypress trees around it. And it got up to maybe 5 feet deep out in the middle, six. Okay. And but they were hanging out with their girlfriends and boyfriends, and they didn't want me around. So they sent me down the railroad track, and this is probably at age like six, seven years old.
Okay.
And they'd say, go down to the baby wading pool. And the baby wading pool was a little shallow gravel shoal downstream of the deep pool where the swimming hole was. And I'd go down there and play, make myself, you know, throw rocks and splash around, whatever. They had no idea where I was. I could have drowned down there and washed down Blue Eye Creek, and they wouldn't have known about it for a couple of hours until I got ready to go home and started calling me up. But that's where I learned to swim. I taught myself to swim. I cannot remember when I did not know how to swim, because I got in there and just paddled around. All of a sudden, I figured it out.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I was kind of a feral kid there during the summers with my sisters. And my mom was always busy canning stuff out of the garden or making quilts on the front porch with her sisters. And but, yeah, it was Blue Eye Creek was that was central to my existence in the summertime. And then later years, my best friend, Gus Colvin, who was the son of the doctor, the town doctor, he and I explored every inch of Blue Eye Creek. I mean, we went skinny dipping in it just about every month out of the year. The worst I remember was in January one year, and it was sort of a dare. We were about 11, 12 years old. It's like, I dare you to go in. So I watch this. So I take my clothes off and I jump in. Well, he wasn't going to be outdone, so he jumped in.
Oh, my.
We stood there and shivered for a while and got the hell out, but it was like freezing cold.
How do you spell Gus's last name?
Colvin, Colvin.
Thank you. Thank you.
Gus, by the way, went on to be got his law degree at the University of Alabama. In fact, he and I were there about the same time. And because he was a year older than I. And he wound up as a county judge in Calhoun, Calhoun, in Calhoun County, Alabama.
Okay, nice. So this would have been after the war. You were 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, going on through the late 40s into the early 50s. Did your parents go on, in you know, the traditional, in quotes, vacations with the station wagon kind of thing?
We were so broke.
Uh-huh.
Our vacations were the family's houses.
Okay.
We my dad had a sister, Aunt Willie, and she lived in a little place called Hico, H-I-C-O, I think, Louisiana. And every summer we would pack up the car, and I don't know how we got four kids and two adults. Well, I know how. We were stuffed in there like sardines in a car and drove for like hours on end to get to North Mississippi from Central Alabama.
Okay.
And we always left at like, maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when it was cool.
Okay.
And Mom would wrap a glass gallon jug with newspapers the night before and fill it up with ice and put it in the fridge. In the morning, she poured the tea in there, sweet tea. And so we had a gallon of sweet tea to drink, and she had made usually peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or cheese and crackers. And we would drive, and we usually had lunch at Vicksburg, Mississippi, because there was a park overlooking the Mississippi River there. I imagine that's a federal or national park now. It was a Civil War park.
Okay.
That's where we always had lunch. And then got in the car across the Mississippi River and on to Hico, Louisiana. And my one the most fearful thing about that trip, those trips we made every summer, was going across the Mississippi River, because the bridge in Vicksburg, on the north side, upstream side of the bridge, had a railroad track. And I swear the train was no more than inches away from
wow.
the roadway. And I just remember thinking, God, I hope we don't meet a train. And the main thing that was scary about it, the train was so heavy and rumbled, long freight train, that the bridge actually shook.
Right.
And it was a hell of a long way down to the river.
Wow.
And I thought, I can swim, but I don't know if I could. I don't know if I'd survive that fall if that train. And I was always so relieved when we got on the other side of the river and we hadn't met a train on the bridge. It was like, woo, made it.
Wow.
But those 10 or so, 12 years that we went out there that I remember, basically it just got, odds are, you know, you probably wouldn't have a train on the bridge. It seemed like it must have been a busy track, because more often than not, there was a damn train on the track same time we were.
Oh, wow.
But that was our summer vacation.
So yeah. So in Hiko, what did you do? You were there for a couple weeks, I'm assuming, family?
We'd usually be there for about a week, 10 days,
okay.
and head back. But my mom or my dad's sister, her husband, and they had a bunch of kids, three or four.
Okay.
And they, well, my uncle Melvin, Aunt Willie's husband, he worked at a gas plant north of there.
Okay.
And the gas plant had a family swimming pool.
Oh, wow.
And that was one of the highlights of the trip, because I got to go to a cement pool.
Wow.
And I had never been in a cement pool. I'd only been in Blue Eye Creek to go swimming. So, but then there's a little bit later, I guess this was when I was around 12. Yeah, it's not 12, I guess, maybe 11 or 12. We, my mom's brother had a job with a fabric mill, and I was trying to think of the name of it. That'll come to me. But anyway, one of the perks for working for this company, Avondale, that's what it was, Avondale Mills,
okay.
in Sylacauga, Alabama. And
where in Alabama?
Sylacauga, Sylacauga.
Okay.
In Sylacauga, Alabama, where my uncle lived and worked for this milling company making cloth.
Okay.
One of the perks was they got to use the big house down on St. Andrews Bay near Panama City, Florida. So we had a family get together, and I mean the Williams clan, my family plus her brother, some of her brothers and sisters that could make it, and some of their kids. It's sort of a different group every year because some of them were working and couldn't come or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But there was always at least 18, 20 of us that all the kids slept out on quilts on the porch and got eaten alive by mosquitoes. I mean, they ate us up. But that was my first view of the Gulf of Mexico, and I just fell in love with it.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, it was – I could not get enough of the ocean going up in the hills in East Alabama. But those are about the only things we did in terms of a vacation.
Okay.
And that was in the summers, I was trying to remember. It seems like the summers we went down to the coast, to Panama City. I guess there were a couple of those that we went to Aunt Willie's, too, so maybe we did both. But, you know, the summers in our house were always extremely busy because we always had – Dad would rent land from somebody that was open so we could plant a garden, and – we always had huge gardens.
Okay.
And because both my mom and dad came out of an agricultural farming sort of families.
Okay.
Not wealthy farming families, but subsistence farming families.
Okay.
And my mom spent the summers, everything that could be canned, it went in it was like a canning operation. Every 2 or 3 days, there was something to can.
Wow.
And, God, I remember 1 year or several years when I was in my early teens, probably 12, 13, along there, we would go down to Central East Alabama, and buy peaches for canning because Mom and Dad, even though we had a peach orchard in Lincoln, Alabama, the peaches were cost too much because he sold them. There was high demand and low volume, one peach farm, and that was it. So we drove down to a place near Clanton, Alabama. And in Clanton, there was all these roadside stands along a busy U.S. highway, I think Highway 82, and they would sell peaches on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then on Monday, when the traffic volume dropped off, everybody went back to work, they'd have all these peaches left over. They'd been sitting there for 2 or 3 days. They were ripe, and they sold them very cheap.
Okay.
So we would go down there and buy literally 8-10 bushels of peaches.
Wow.
And I can remember riding in the back seat of the car eating peaches till I thought I'd get sick. And we'd get home, and then it was everything from pickled peaches to just canned peaches to whatever. And that was all to feed a family of five, four kids and two adults, six.
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere along the way, in about, what year would that have been? Mom, I know I was about 12 or so, but, I guess it's about 1953 it would have been. I had a younger brother pop up, and I'll never forget Mom calling me in after Dr. Gus had been to the house. Dr. Gus made house calls back
okay.
in those days.
Yeah.
Anyway, I had to leave the house, and Dr. Gus left, and Mom calls me in. And I knew she'd been throwing up and was sick, and I was kind of worried about her. I didn't know what was going on. And I guess in 53, I would have been, 12 years old or so. And she said, well, James David, I think you're going to have a little brother or sister before long. And I thought, wow, I must have given her some really strong medicine. She's talking out of her head. She's crazy. She can't have another one. And I was about 10. My oldest brother, Bill, was 20 at the time,
mm-hmm.
and had already gone on to college. And along comes my younger brother.
Okay.
And so.
What was his name?
Nick. He's a junior.
Okay.
My dad was Dewey Nicholson Williams. And Nicholson, Nicholson Williams. And so born in February 1953 was my younger brother, Nick, who was junior, Dewey Nicholson Williams Jr. And so that rounded out the fifth kid. And so we were strung out between my brother, oldest brother was born in 1931, and Nick was born in 53, so... 22 years strung out with five kids there.
Yeah, yeah.
But
what were your sister's names?
That turned out to be pardon?
What were your sister's names?
Let's see. My oldest brother was Billy Gunter, Gunter Williams. And my oldest sister is Effie Jean, Effie Jean Williams. And my next sister was Julia Ann Williams,
okay.
Just A-N-N, and then I came along September 40. Jean was born in 1933. She's a couple years after Bill, and Judy didn't come along until about 4 or 5 years later. She was in 1937,
okay,
and then I was born in 1941 and Nick in 53,
right.
So
okay,
that was the five kids. All of us went to school. All of us got degrees. Most of us, let's see, Bill, myself, and I think Judy all got at least master's. I wound up with PhD. Yeah, that was all coming out of a family where my mom did not finish high school.
Okay.
And my dad had to, his family was, things were not easy in his life. He had one sister. His father had a drinking problem,
okay.
An alcoholic. His mom died at an early age, so he wound up raising his sister. And some of this during the Depression, I remember him telling that there were times one summer when they lived off of syrup, sorghum syrup, which they had made out of a cane, and biscuits. And they had flour, a little salt, and lard, and they made biscuits. And that was their existence for one summer.
That would have been during the Depression or before?
Yeah,
then?
during the Depression. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they were my entire family on both sides had no money. I mean, it's typical. It was like everybody else in Alabama at the
mm-hmm.
time. You scratched out a living, and
yeah.
you made ends meet, and you paid your bills, you went to church. And but there was no frills. And,
right.
School teacher
like...
salary in Alabama. School teacher salary in Alabama was subsistence living. And, and what they did, they paid you 9 months. You know, you taught school for 9 months, and they paid you for 9 months.
Okay.
So that 10, 11, 12, that other 3 months,
right.
you had to get out and hustle a job in the summer. So my dad got all sorts of odd jobs in the summertime. He did things like measuring cropland for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, because in Alabama there were cotton allotments, and the government would not allow you to plant over a certain amount of cotton, because if you did, it would flood the market and the price would go down and everybody would be broke then.
Right.
So they kept the prices artificially high on cotton by limiting how much was planted.
Okay.
And so my dad's job was taking these big aerial photographs, which I loved, just fell in love with them.
Oh, wow.
They were like 3x3 aerial photographs. And he would sit there at night and map out, you know, whose farms he was going to check, see what they were planting, because the aerial photographs were made like the year before. They shouldn't have any more than they've got now. And so we'd go out there, and I'd ride around with him, help him with, occasionally we'd do tape measures on some of it, but not much of it. He could just look at the maps and tell where the tree line was and do it all. But, yeah, it
nice.
Was
and
scrambling
so
in the summer.
It sounds like your parents, certainly your father, really valued education and worked hard to share what he was doing with his children. Is that
absolutely.
A correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. It was like, I grew up, I didn't know how I was going to pay for college or where I was going to college, but I grew up knowing that you're going to get a college education.
Okay.
There was never any choice or any doubt about it. And that was he was the first one in his entire family to ever get an education, probably ever graduate from high school.
Hmm.
And my mom never graduated from high school, and she had some brothers and sisters that did graduate from high school, but they never went. None of them ever went to college. And I know one of the saddest things is my mom's younger sister wanted so bad, because she was incredibly bright, wanted to go to college, and she went down to, she and her dad went down to the bank to try to get a loan to go to college, and the banker's like, I'm not giving you money to go to college. You need to get married and raise family.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just the way things were in those days.
Yep.
And my God, yeah. I look back on some of it and it's like, I can't believe. But education was our way. It was my mom and dad's way of making sure that we did not live the way they had to live, which was scratching out a living.
Right.
They wanted us to do better.
Yeah.
And we all did.
Yeah.
All five of us. And
in junior high, what school classes did you excel in?
None.
Okay.
I was a reluctant student.
Okay.
I wanted to do what I wanted to do.
Ah.
And which was play football,
okay,
baseball, or basketball.
Okay.
And my entire early years in junior high school and high school were all about sports.
Okay.
I will say that one year I had this teacher that taught science, and he got me pretty damned interested in chemistry. And he got me interested in chemistry, I think, only because he could blow things up.
Okay.
And so he showed us how you could mix powdered metals and how flammable they were. You know, okay. Powdered zinc,
yep,
powdered
yep.
manganese,
yep.
And then wham. And it's like, wow, that's pretty damn exciting. But I cared absolutely nothing. I hated biology.
Okay.
Did not want anything to do with that. That was a messy science. And my math skills, I never really developed because my dad was a math teacher.
Okay.
And by that time, I had my dad and my brother-in-law, Gene's husband, was teaching, and I had Howard for algebra and geometry. I liked geometry. I was very spatially oriented, I guess, in part, I think, from looking at all those maps
yeah.
over the years. But angles and circles and shapes intrigued me. And so that part of it, I sort of latched on to in geometry. It did well, but algebra's like, oh, who the hell needs this?
Hmm.
And my dad, part of it was, I think, a rebellion against my dad. My dad, bless his heart, was always so worried about money. I mean, he figured our budget down to the nickel,
wow.
literally, to the nickel every month. And you couldn't go over that. And try to stay under that. And I didn't know what an allowance was. I knew some of my friends got it, but I never got it.
Mm-hmm.
And which taught me at an early age, if you want something, go out and work for it.
Right.
And so I worked up I had some regular customers that I trimmed hedges, raked yards, cut grass. And that's how I made my money in the summer.
Okay.
And when I got up to be a teenager, I could go buy a record with it, but a record cost 99 cents,
mm.
45. And that was expensive. But yeah, back to I didn't really excel in it. If I applied myself, I would make an A in geometry maybe, or a B. And in science, when I was in 9th, 10th grades, I actually got into that and actually won I think it was second or third place in a science fair in school one year because I made a one-tube radio set.
Oh, wow.
But I did.
A one-tube?
One-tube radio set. And I got it out of something like Popular Mechanics. But I did that the year that I broke my ankle playing basketball.
Ah.
And so I'm sitting around with nothing to do, so I started reading Popular Mechanics, and I can make a one-tube radio set. So I made a one-tube radio set.
Cool.
Yeah, it was. I also got into wrapping coils around pieces of metal to make a motor,
okay.
And I did that because I had a bunch of old horseshoe-shaped magnets that I'd gotten out of old wall ring-up telephones that you used to ring up the operator with, yeah. But, it was, those were sort of the things that I got into, but otherwise I was in the basketball gym, playing basketball, or out working on my tennis game, or my football skills. I was always playing ball of some kind.
Okay.
All the time.
So your broken ankle didn't slow you down too much?
It didn't slow me down much. It happened in like February and early February, and I was on crutches March, April. I think probably I got it off sometime early May. So it was in the cast for a couple of months, but it knocked me out of my basketball that year as well as baseball. So. That was the year I gave up baseball, I guess. I never played baseball after that.
Okay.
And that was my sophomore year, and then in my junior year, I only played football. Yeah.
Okay. And senior as well?
Senior year is when we moved to Brunswick, Georgia.
Ah.
And
what was that like, leaving all your friends behind in high school?
Well,
I mean, girlfriends,
you know,
and all that kind of stuff happening then?
This
and
was really, everybody that I ever tell my story to, it's like, well, it must have been a blow to leave your high school after your junior year. And it's like, yeah, but I left a little crossroads, literally a crossroads on US 78, 40 miles east of Birmingham, Lincoln, Alabama. I left that to go to Brunswick, Georgia, which is on the coast.
Ooh.
And all of a sudden, I'm in a beach town my senior year in high school. And, I forgot to add, my brother had moved around in Alabama coaching jobs, my brother Billy, or Bill. And, but he wound up in Brunswick a couple years before we did.
Okay.
And he was making money hand over fist compared to what he was making in Alabama. So my dad looked at that and said, we can't afford it. We're getting nowhere. We're barely breaking even here in Alabama teaching. So we figured out a way to move to Brunswick, Georgia, my senior year in high school, which would have been the summer of 1958.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we get there in June. I get a job working in a produce store, and I started meeting all these young ladies coming in with their moms and dads, and I would occasionally get introduced or introduce myself, and school started that September, and I played football, and my brother was a football coach. He was assistant coach, not the head coach.
Okay.
And I had a great year playing football, and it was I did not play basketball or baseball that year because all of my not applying myself in a small county high school in Alabama caught up with me my senior year.
How so?
They were really serious about education in Glenn County schools. And all of a sudden, I had to work my buns off, and I did enough to get by because they never looked at your high school grades. If you went to college, if you had the money, you signed up and you went.
Okay.
And that was before SATs and all these other.
Right.
Let me put it like this. Had I graduated even 5 years later, 10 years later, I probably could not have gotten into college because of my grades. I mean, they were lousy.
Okay.
And it's because I didn't apply myself. I didn't want.
Right.
I wanted to do what I wanted to do and leave me alone, you know.
Right.
Don't bother me. So. And I'll admit, my senior in high school, I went from Lincoln, Alabama, where all the girls I had known since the first grade, I'd seen every one of them
right.
in school and church, and it's like I was so bored with the selection of girls. I sort of never really got into dating when I was in Lincoln, Alabama. And I made up for it my senior in high school.
Okay.
I had a different girlfriend about every week. Well, I'd break up with one on Monday or Sunday, and then I'd start dating another for a couple of weeks and break up with her. And I was known as the heartbreaker or whatever because I'd date all these girls. They'd be very interested for about a month. Time to move on.
Oh, my. Okay.
But it was... I was good enough in football that I did get a scholarship, football scholarship,
ooh.
To Middle Georgia College. It was a junior college,
okay.
two-year college, but my goal was to go there for 2 years, play football, get very good at it, and then maybe go on to University of Alabama or to maybe University of Georgia. Because I graduated, well, my junior year in high school in Lincoln, Alabama, we had two guys that were seniors that played on our team that got both of them got scholarships to the University of Alabama. They were
okay.
that good.
Okay. Wow.
And I thought, hell, if Richard O'Dell and Frank Hopper can do it, I think I'm as good as they were because they were playing. One of them played ends, one on the left, one on the right. And they played both offense and defense back in those days. So, anyway, I played 1 year junior college football, and that was the last year they had football at Middle Georgia College for a while. So that was the end of the program. It was just getting too costly to support, and, you know, it's a community college, and most of the kids around there went home on the weekends, so they didn't attend the game on Friday night Saturday night, and so we might have 200 or 300 people show up for a game, and there just was not enough gate receipts to pay for the entire team with room and board and books, you know, and tuition. So they just dropped it after a year. So with that, I left for Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And
so in Middle Georgia, when you were there, in your first year of college, were you just looking at a general degree, and football was your be and end all?
I was pretty much thinking of myself right then as probably winding up as a coach somewhere.
Okay.
I can get a degree in education and teach and coach football.
Okay.
That was my goal. And God, I love football. Still do.
Okay. All right.
And so, yeah, that was my passion. And I got the University of Alabama in the summer of, that would have been 1960, I guess. So I graduated high school in 59. Summer of 60, I got the University of Alabama.
And you wouldn't have had a scholarship for that, so how are you going to pay for that?
No. Well, I got student loans.
Okay.
I got a National Defense Education Act student loan, and the fact that my brother had a scholarship at the University of Alabama and played football there, Bill, he knew all the people in the athletic department. So he got me a deal where I could stay. This is sort of really off the track, but there was a room in Foster Auditorium that they had for student athletes that were off scholarship but needed another semester to finish their degree.
Okay.
So rather they couldn't support them in the usual way, but they give them a free room in Foster Auditorium. And it was just one big room. And I got there, and when I got there, there was only one athlete in the room, and there's two other guys that their dads had played football in Alabama, and they needed a place to stay.
Okay.
So they put us up. It was through the connection of the athletic department that I wound up living in Foster Auditorium for the next couple of years. But I started to, I went over and talked. My brother set me up. By this time, Bear Bryant had arrived at the University of Alabama. And I went over and talked to a couple of the assistant coaches, and they started asking me some of my stats about speed, size, and looked me over. And I wanted to at least try out maybe as a walk-on.
Okay.
And they said, look, let's just be honest about this. Don't bother. I was not the fastest person in the race, I'll put it that way.
Okay.
So I weighed about 195 pounds. I was fairly well-built and pretty stout and muscular, but they looked and talked to me some about speed, and they said, nah, don't bother. So, okay. So I'm living in Foster Auditorium anyway, and I started summer school that summer, and I took a class, and I thought, at Middle Georgia College, I'd taken botany. And so I took botany, got a decent grade in that because I liked the professor.
Okay.
It was sort of interesting. But then I get to the University of Alabama, and my brother was advising me. He says, all right, you need to get some of these general classes out of the way. And because what I was going to do, my thought process was, if I go summer and winter for 3 years,
yep.
Well, three years, and then the summer – two summers in between, I can make up that other year, and I can graduate in 3 years instead of four.
Yep.
And I'll make more money that fourth year teaching somewhere than I will in two summers. So
right.
It was all about money. So okay. I started school in June, and my first term of summer school, I took general zoology. And I had a professor, Dr. Bishop, and he made fascinating. I was on the edge of my seat.
Wow.
It just clicked. It totally clicked in June of that year, 1960. And he's like, wow, I'm going to be a biologist.
Wow. That's a huge change.
It was a huge change. And
I mean, in a way, not, because you'd grown up, along the rivers and out in the woods.
Creeks,
and,
yep. Woods. Yep.
So you'd know, you saw the natural world in action.
I just didn't understand it. And all of a sudden, this guy was making total sense of all these things I'd seen all my life.
Nice.
And it just all clicked. It's like, damn, this is really fascinating. And so I took another class that fall and just in botany, and I found another guy that I really liked, and Dr. Herndon, and he convinced me that I didn't want to be a zoologist. I wanted to be a botanist.
Ooh.
So for the next year, a year and a half of my college education, I took more botany classes than I did zoology classes.
Okay.
I had to take some zoology because I had to have a mix for a degree to teach. But, yeah, I was going to be a biology teacher then. So
okay.
I went on along the way, and I managed to graduate in 3 years. So I graduated in 62. And
your degree was in botany or zoology?
As a bachelor's degree in education, and
okay.
I was going to go out and start teaching. And then a funny thing happened my last
Hey, Jim, hang on a second here. I want to back up a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the Korean War conflict, which was in the second half of the 1950s there.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have been of draftable age in that time. How did, or did you come in just after the Korean conflict?
No, I came in just after.
Okay.
My brother went, well, he was drafted and was trained, but wound up staying, he got a deferment. And I'll tell you how he got his deferment was through the athletic department at the University of Alabama.
Ah, got it.
They got student deferments for a number of players, and all colleges did this. It wasn't just Alabama.
Right, right.
They wanted student athletes that could compete, and so they didn't have to rile people like me.
Okay.
To fill the rank. So yeah. But my brother Bill was of age during that period, but mine was more the Vietnam War.
I was going to say that's coming up
the next few years.
Right.
Coming up. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to you graduated in 62 at summer.
Yeah.
You were thinking, all right, I'm going to teach. And then what happened?
Then something happened. So the last summer, the last thing I did that last summer to get my last 6 hours was called practice teaching. And I did my practice teaching general biology at Tuscaloosa High School. And I had to wear a tie every day. And it was hot as hell. The school was not air conditioned in Alabama. And I had two groups of students in the class. I had the ones that had flunked general biology, so they were retaking in the summer. And then I had another group of students that were taking the first introductory class to biology, Biology 1, so they could take Biology 2 in the fall. So I had two groups of students, the really, really good and the really, really bad. And I realized during that couple months of practice teaching, I thought, I have made a big mistake.
Hmm.
I cannot manage high school kids. I don't like them. I don't want to be around them.
Huh.
They're stupid. They won't do what I tell them to do. It was all the things that were coming. It was coming back to me in spades.
Hmm.
My God, this was me a few years ago. Oh, God, what have I done? And so I went over to the education department. I said, I went to the biology department. Said, could I work on a master's degree this fall? They said, oh, we're already full. We've already taken all the students in. I thought, oh, okay. I thought, oh, God, what am I going to do? So I went over to the Department of Education, and I said, could I work on a master's degree in education this fall? They said, well, we've got a couple slots here for a non-thesis program track that you can go through, and 30 hours, and you can get a master's degree. And I thought, ah, okay. So instead of graduating and leaving and going making money, and by that time I'd gotten a pretty serious girlfriend and in the picture. So I decided I was going to stay on and get my master's in education, because, and take some courses in biology, which you had to do as part of your master's in education, because you took, like, I think 6 or maybe 8 hours in your major field, and the rest was in education classes.
Okay.
And so I thought, if I get this master's degree in education, that will qualify to me, well, it'll qualify me to teach in some of the junior colleges, which will begin to open up around the state of Alabama.
Okay.
So I thought, that's what I'll do. And so I enroll in the Department of Education for a master's program for 1 year to get my master's degree in education. And during that time, I got married. That was in December of 1962.
Okay. Who'd you get married to?
Anna McIntyre, McIntyre. And Anna was from Washington, D.C.
Oh, really?
And her dad sent her to the University of Alabama because it had a great football team. I'm not kidding you.
Really?
I'm not kidding you. I am serious. He loved football. He was a lawyer.
My gosh. Money,
and he had, Anna was the only kid. And so he said, go to the University of Alabama. They've got a great football team down there.
What did she get her degree in? What was she studying?
She was in biology. In fact, I met her in the human anatomy lab of all places.
Okay.
And, but I've got to add, the other thing that happened to me my last semester, not the summer school, but the spring semester before summer school in practice teaching, I took this course in field zoology. And this is what I tell people about forks in the road in your life.
Yes.
I had taken all these classes in botany, and I was going to be a botanist. And, I mean, I would love botany. Mm. I mean, I was into it in a big way. I love primitive vascular plants, ferns, and lycopodiums, and all those things. Then that semester, last semester before I did my practice teaching, I took a 4-hour class in vertebrate field zoology.
Okay.
And the only reason I took it, it only had 2 hours of lecture, and it had a 4-hour lab, which was, it said in the catalog, you'll be out in the field doing all this stuff.
Okay.
Well, the only reason I signed up for that was because the botany class that I wanted to take, by the time I got there, because my name was Williams and registered late, because it did by the alphabet, those classes were full. So I remember sitting down, and I thought, geez, I don't want to go back and sit around and wait for my damn advisor. So he'd already signed my slip saying this is what you should take, graduate. So I thought, it doesn't really matter as long as it's a biology class. So I looked at the catalog, and here's this vertebrate field zoology taught by Dr. Boshung, B-O-S-C-H-U-N-G. And Dr. Boshung, I knew of, didn't know him well, seen him around the department a lot, seemed like a nice guy.
Okay.
So I signed up for field zoology, and that flipped another switch.
Wow.
I went in one semester from being a botanist to I'm going to be an ichthyologist.
Wow.
So I took my, I went on and got my, to get my master's in education, but for my outside hours in biology, I did a special project under Bo doing a fish survey on a river north of Tuscaloosa there, North River. And I hung around the fish lab a lot, and I got to know the people in the fish lab, and I really liked it. So when I finished my master's in education,
that would have been in 63?
That would have been 63.
Okay.
And I said, you know, I think I, I know what I did for the rest of my hours, outside hours. I went to the Gulf Coast Research Lab and took another class down there in marine vertebrates, and which included everything. Well, birds and mammals got taught the first day, and the rest of it was ichthyology.
Wow.
Okay. At the Gulf Coast Research Lab in Ocean Springs, Mississippi. And Bo was a professor, so by the end of that time period, that would have been 63, August 63, I get my master's in education. By this time, I've had the vertebrate fields O class with Bo on campus, then I had the marine vertebrates on the coast. And I knew then that I had to do ichthyology. So I asked Bo about, and that summer I knew what was coming, so I tried to get into the biology department to work on a master's. And I wanted to do a non-thesis. And they said, you can't do a non-thesis. That's only for people who are coming back in the summertime to get their master's degree.
Ooh.
And said, you are not doing that. You're here. You're young. So you've got to go through a master's and do a thesis project.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, my God, I have trouble with the damn term paper. How could I ever write a thesis? Well, it didn't take long. I got into a master's program, and my master's thesis was on fishes of the Tallapoosa River system in Alabama and Georgia. It was a stream all the way over to the eastern part of the
state.
Wait.
Run that past me again. The fishes of the what river?
Tallapoosa. Tallapoosa.
F-A? River. As in Frank?
Tallapoosa. Tallapoosa.
S-A. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Where was that river?
It's East Alabama. Heads up in West Georgia and drains into Alabama, and eventually it joins the Coosa to form the Alabama River.
Okay.
So it's a major river system in the state.
Okay.
And nobody had ever surveyed this river. Nobody made very many collections over there. The interesting thing about it is it crosses a fall line that's about two-thirds of the river system above the fall line and a third of it below. The fall line is basically, it's kind of like the some of the features out west, like the Mogollon Rim or something, that only the fall line in Alabama is where the old Cretaceous shoreline is. It's a coastal plain, separates the coastal plain from the upland provinces, the Piedmont, Valley and Ridge, and Cumberland Plateau, and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So it cuts across the state. It's a huge divide. I mean, it literally splits the state into two or three different worlds.
Huh.
But it's one that my project in doing this river fish survey was to determine the effect the fall line had on distribution of fishes in the river. In other words, are there some things above the fall line only and some things below the fall line only?
When
they cross the fall line?
When you say fall line, I think of a weir sort of structure going all the way across a river that's got like a 10-foot drop in it.
It's a drop. It's where the rivers come off the hard rocks onto the coastal plain, which is all sands and gravels and clays.
And easily erodible.
Easily erodible. So you get the fall line is because of the waterfalls.
I mean, how tall? How tall a fall are we talking here?
Well, it's the ones that on the Tallapoosa River were maybe, I only saw photographs on them because Alabama Power Company dammed them up.
Huh.
But the falls were maybe 10 or 15 feet high.
Oh, wow. That's
it was like cascading. It's like cascading falls, though. It wasn't like a Niagara Falls vertical drop of.
Yeah, but as a fish or some sort of invertebrate,
yeah.
If you can't climb, if you can't make that jump.
Exactly.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that cut across the Coosa River at Wetumpka. In fact, if you look at in the southeast, we have the fall line, which cuts all across Georgia and up the Atlantic coast. All the major cities and a lot of the southeastern towns are built on the fall line because you had boat traffic that could navigate up to the fall line because the rivers were deeper and didn't have all these shoals. Or at least they only had gravel shoals rather than rock shoals, which wouldn't sink your boat.
Right.
And so they built Tuscaloosa's on the fall line in the Black Warrior River. And Centerville, Alabama, is on the fall line on the Cahaba River, a trib of the Alabama River. And Wetumpka is built on the fall line on the Coosa River. And Tallahassee, TALLASSEE, Tallahassee, Alabama, is on the phone line in the Tallapoosa.
Okay, all right.
And if you go around Augusta, Georgia, for example, and Macon and Columbus, all those three towns in Georgia, they're built on fall lines on major rivers.
Wow, fascinating.
Yeah, huh. Yeah. So that was my master's thesis, and before long I got into it. I thought, I wonder if I could do two theses and not take some of these damn classes.
Wow.
I love the research. I finally, working in my master's in biology, I finally found my niche in the world. It's like, I want to be a research biologist, and I want to study fish and maybe some of these other things that live in freshwater, but I really want to work on fish.
Hey, Jim, hang on a second. Let's back up for a minute and just capture a couple threads here.
Yeah.
What were your folks thinking when you told them you were abandoning your prospects as a teacher there, graduating from college, and saying, well, I'm heading off to do a master's degree and I'm studying fish?
Well, funny you should mention that. In 1962, I guess it was, at Christmas, well, Ann and I got married December 1962.
Okay.
And then I guess it was later that spring and all, because I was thinking about going on for a master's in biology. And I remember my mom and dad saying, you know, James, you need, they call me James David. I got Jim because my wife, Anna, did not like James. She said it sounded too weird for me or something. So I people who in my family knew me as James David or James. And all my friends and associates from graduate school on know me as Jim.
Okay.
So that was my dichotomy there.
Hmm.
They talked to me. They said, look, oh, and I forgot to add, and we got married in December 62, and in 1963, Anna got pregnant with our first child, and it was at that point, I guess, that my mom and dad said, look, you need to move along with this education, get over this education thing, because I was already thinking, I'm going on for a PhD here. I just might do that.
Ah.
And they said, no, you need to think about getting out, make a living. You need to get your wife, and you want to have a kid. You need to get them out of marriage student housing. Which, marriage student housing at the University of Alabama at the time was an old army barracks that they converted into housing. And it was quite the place. It had no air conditioning until we got, I guess it was when David, he was born in March. I guess the grandparents came down in late March after he'd been home for a few weeks and things had settled down a little bit. And this is Anna's parents coming down from D.C. And they said, my God, you have no air conditioning in this place. They were staying in a hotel.
Okay.
And just, they'd come to the house to visit for the day. And so as they left, they gave us a check to go buy a window air conditioning unit to plug
in.
Well, so we went and got a big air conditioning unit, which made life so much better.
Jim, I'm thinking about Anna here. Did she have aspirational goals for teaching or being a career-oriented woman, or did she want to raise a family?
She was basically, I'd say it's more getting married and raising a family.
Okay.
She was an only child, and her parents had been divorced when she was little, so she grew up with her mom, but her dad lived across town, and she saw her dad on weekends and special occasions, and in fact, her mom died. We were married in December 62, and her mom died on Mother's Day in 63.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And but she never really, Anna was a very bright, sharp woman, and I think had we'd not gotten married so young, and if we had not had kids, mm-hmm. by the way, that she might have gone on. But She was by this time, I think, more interested in psychology.
Okay.
And she's more like animal behavior and psychology was her thing. And, but basically, when you get married in December and then you get pregnant and then you have a child, let's say married 62. Yeah. She got pregnant in 63 and David was born in 64.
Okay.
62, 3-4. Yeah.
Thank you. I wasn't going to say anything there, but I was like,
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
The hardware's been tested here, and now you're getting married. Yeah. Okay, well, at least it works.
Yeah.
No. I got this wrong here. this is a year out. Okay, 64.
Yeah.
So it sounds like your folks were saying, get a job.
You've had enough education. Get out and get a job.
but you and your wife were like, no, this is really a fascinating thing that's going on here. Can we make it work? Staying in school.
Yep.
How did you work that out?
Well, Anna supported me.
Okay.
And she didn't like living in married student housing, but she the idea that I could go and get a PhD meant that I would be either a professor at a university or I'd go to work maybe in some museum as an ichthyologist. And so we had a vision. A shared vision that worked.
Nice. Back up a minute, because before you went for the PhD, last you left me, was you were looking at getting a second master's thesis.
Yeah.
Did you do that?
Yeah, I had the master's in education, and then I got a master's in biology.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And the master's in biology took 3 years, I think.
Okay.
Let's see. Yeah, and then
and that was on the Tallapoosa River.
Tallapoosa.
Okay.
Yeah. Tallapoosa River fishes. Yeah.
Let's go off to the Tallapoosa just for a minute here, and I think then maybe
yeah.
we'll wrap this up. What was the most amazing thing you found about that river system that you wrote about in your thesis?
Well, what I found, I only wrote about some of it in my thesis.
Okay.
It's like a lot of research projects. When you get into solving or answering one question, you raise 20 more.
Right.
You know, it just multiplies. Well, what I did show, in fact, that the fall line was a barrier to distribution of fishes
okay.
in the Tallapoosa, at least some species. And so I had these things that were above the fall line and below the fall line that were throughout. The common things, bluegill, bass, catfish, and so on, and a lot of the minnows and suckers. But then there are a bunch of things that occurred only above and rocky habitat and things only below in the sand and gravel habitat.
Okay.
So it really sorted some things out. But in the meantime, I discovered a couple of new species.
Oh, wow.
Undescribed. Yeah. So that's where the thesis became just the vehicle to get my degree with. And I started working on descriptions of these new species.
Wow. So hang on a second, because I'm assuming that the species division based on the fall line that would have been a known thing.
Yeah, it was we knew it was an isolated mechanism, but we weren't sure to what extent. And see, there are a lot of things, in fact, the fishes that I found that were different, new species. One of them occurred, for example, over in the Coosa River system, and at one point it apparently occurred in the Coosa and the Tallapoosa, but it had become isolated because of the fall, and occurred only above the fall line.
Now that would have been the snap your head around and pay attention there.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
So we've got these things that are endemic to the Coosa. And well, we thought Coosa and Tallapoosa are now, they're endemic to the Coosa, and there's another species over here in the Tallapoosa.
Wow. Different.
Yeah. And different. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
And I collected a lot of material. I basically was overwhelmed with it. I collected so much material that the ichthyology in the southeast at the time was absolutely exploding.
Okay.
We had grad students at Florida State University. We had grad students at Auburn. We had grad students at Alabama. We had grad students at Tulane. We had grad students at Northeast Louisiana State. We had grad students at the University of Tennessee. And so there's six institutions right there with a bunch of grad students all working on fish problems.
Wow.
Plus we had students at Cornell that were working and saying, wow, oh, look at all that diversity down there in Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia and Tennessee. So there was a whole cadre of grad students from Cornell University that worked on fish problems in the Southeast.
Wow. Huh.
And so it was, and that's, by the way, is where I met Glenn Klemmer, who I went down the canyon with. Glenn was at Tulane.
Okay.
And so he's a grad student with Artie Sutkus at Tulane. And,
how do you spell Glenn's last name?
Klemmer, C-L-E-M-M-E-R.
Okay. All right.
But yeah,
maybe.
But yeah, that was really the Tallapoosa. Was, I said, on the way over there, I met this. Oh God, this is one of the things that goes back to the grad school days when. When you're a grad student, you're going to have to do things that professors don't want to do. No surprise there.
Uh-huh.
And one of them was judging a science fair for high school kids. So Bo didn't want to do this. He said, Jim, you and another grad student too, go down there and do these projects that involve aquatics and fish and stuff. Just go down there and do them, judge them. And it's like, okay. I'm down there judging, and I look in this tank with this kid standing there, this 18-year-old kid, senior in high school, and he's got his science fair, and it's on the ecology of Coldwater Spring near Anniston, Alabama.
Ooh.
And so I look in his tank, and by this time I've collected a lot of sculpins, genus Cottus, C-O-T-T-U-S, and I'm looking in there, and I said, where did you get these sculpins in here, cottus? Oh, those came out of the spring. He said they're in the spring. They're pretty common in there. And I'm looking at them thinking, I have never seen anywhere in the state of Alabama a sculpin that looks like that. So I said, so exactly where's the spring? And then I got real interested in John's project. And he did very well in my review of his site. And so before he left, he allowed that he was going to attend the University of Alabama that fall. And when he got there, he was coming over to, I took him out and showed him the fish lab and,
nice.
And showed him around.
Okay.
And he said, I'll be here. I'm coming over. I'll be in school this fall. I'll be a freshman. And if you need any help, I'll take you over there one weekend. We'll go over there and I'll show you exactly. I was like, okay, well, that's what we're going to do. So on the way to the Tallapoosa, John Hall and I stopped at Coldwater Spring. And I knew immediately. When I collected these things, this is a new species.
Wow.
So not only did I find things in the Tallapoosa, I was finding them on the way over there. And
wow.
So, yeah, that was quite a trip. And John went on to help me so much with my thesis on the other end of the Seine. Because before my thesis was over with, people would see me coming on Thursday, Friday, and they'd run the other way because, oh, God, he's going to ask me to go to that damn river again. And you know, in those days, we all, there was no fund for research. You paid for it. I bought the gasoline out of my pocket. And I paid, you know, my car and upkeep on my car. And my wife, Anna, used to complain about the car always smelling like
dead
riverbank.
Fish. Yeah.
The dead fish in the riverbank. Or formaldehyde, because occasionally you'd spill a little formalin in the trunk of the car.
Uh-huh.
And but we had there was no vehicles at the department.
Wow.
There was no assistance from the department. So if you wanted to do something, you had to go do it.
Yeah, you did it yourself.
Yeah,
huh.
Absolutely. And but yeah, that project, I'm embarrassed to say I never published that thesis.
Really?
But I did, it in pieces and, you know, bits and pieces from other studies. And then I was finding so many other things that were so much more interesting than a thesis problem that I already answered those questions, and so I just let it drop. And
did you get it written? Did you get it written though?
Oh yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It was
just
written,
wasn't
signed off on,
right, but just wasn't published.
It was never published. Yeah.
Huh. Wow.
And but it became, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I must from Cornell, every grad student at Tulane wanted a copy, and Florida State, because it was, I feel basically a big hole in the Mobile base, and that's everything that's strange in the Mobile Bay. And that was an unknown river. Nobody knew what the hell was in it.
Did you get some help writing the thing? I mean, how did you work out your language? I mean, you weren't a great writer, so what did you do with that?
No, I basically, other grad students.
Okay.
We had it was me, Mike, Dale, Charles. Those were the main four that were grad students, and we all occupied an office that had basically had a bench around the wall and a sink, and each person had a little space on the bench, and that was our office space and workspace. But, yeah, sitting there writing, and I was doing this, writing it out by hand and giving it to Anna, who was my typist.
Ah, great.
And, you know, it's funny. I took, when I was in high school in Lincoln, Alabama, I took typing one year, my junior year in high school, and the only reason I took it was because it was full of girls. And it's like, all those girls in there, I'll find somebody that I might want to date. So I'm going to take typing. I went in and learned the home keys, ASDFJKL semicolon. And I didn't use that again until computers came along. But amazingly enough, when I started working on keyboard on computers, it's like it all came back.
Right.
But I never typed anything. I always gave it to Anna during grad school days. And then when I got into, after that, I guess we'll get into it later, I wound up teaching at several universities. And there I always had work-study students or technicians that were working in the department as part of their degree requirements. And they did all my typing for me.
Okay.
And, and we had departmental secretaries that typed tests, so I didn't have to do that, the mimeographing, so... Boy, as soon as when computers came along, I'm back on the keyboard, and I thought, boy, I'm sure glad.
Yeah, that you had that background.
I don't know what
background.
I've done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, what year did you complete your master's, your two master's degrees? Was that in 64 or 65?
Okay. Let's see. I have to count these. Tell you what, hang on just one second, and I'll be precise about this, so we don't have to go back and... make corrections. I tell you what I could do. I could just send you a copy of my CV because it has all my graduation dates in there.
Okay, I'm just, what I'm looking for here is a timeline, because we're going to wrap this up now. And I'm just like, okay, where are we in the timeline? So you were married in 63, had your first child in 64.
I married December
62. Yeah.
Yep. I finished up my master's in education in 63. I finished up my master's in biology in 65.
Okay.
Or 6. And then my PhD I finished in 1969.
Okay, what let's do, let's put a comma here in this oral history, and we will pick this back up. Because I'm going to be curious to know how you decided on what PhD to do and where to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll pick that up next time in 1965 or 66. Great.
Sounds good.
All right. And so with that, this will conclude part one of A Grand Canyon Oral History with James David, Jim Williams. And my name is Tom Martin. Today is August 24th, 2021. And Jim, thank you so very, very much.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.